Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, February 16th. The latest murder to make headline news in New York City may have several things in common with the last one. Christina Lee, who was killed in Chinatown on Sunday when a man followed her into her building, and Michelle Goh, the woman pushed onto the tracks at Times Square last month, were both allegedly killed by men who may have had serious mental health issues. We know that to be the case in the Michelle Goh murder. It is seeming it may well be the case for the man charged with killing Christina Lee. Of course, both victims were Asian American women. We talked about that aspect on yesterday's show about hate crimes. Today, we'll focus on the mental health of alleged perpetrators such as these and why they fall through the cracks until they sometimes do the worst possible thing. In fact, as you'll hear, one of our guests doesn't even like the term fall through the cracks. This is a New York City issue. This is an issue in cities across the country. With me now are New York Times poverty and social services correspondent Andy Newman, who has a story called Decades Adrift in a Broken System, Then Charged with a Death on the Tracks, and Dr. Anthony Carino, MD, Director of Psychiatry at CUCS, Janian Medical Care, a healthcare program for people impacted by homelessness. Andy and Dr. Carino, thank you for coming on and welcome to WNYC today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
Andy, the alleged killer of Michelle Goh is a man named Marshall Simon. Who is he?
Marshall Simon is a guy who he's 61 years old. He was born in Haiti. He came to his family moved to New Jersey when he was a teenager. He led a pretty normal life up until he was in his 30s. He drove a cab. He worked in parking lots. He managed parking lots. And then in his early 30s, according to his sister, he started becoming delusional and was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia. And since the late 90s, he seems to have just been bouncing around the city, homeless pretty much all of the time, except for one year when he went to live with his sister. In and out of hospitals, in and out of jails, being found unfit to stand trial, which means they send you to a mental institution, getting discharged from mental institutions, but without any kind of coordinated care plan. So he just kind of reverts to bouncing around. And we talked to somebody, another homeless guy who had run into him many, many times over the years and actually become friends with him, and said that Marshall Simon used to complain that the doctors were discharging him from the hospital before he could be stable, that he kept running out of his antipsychotic medicines. So just from kind of trying to piece together bits of his life, we came away with the sense that here is a guy who is just basically, adrift, just couldn't really take care of himself well, but no one seemed to be stepping up to really say, hey, this guy is just kind of repeatedly getting back on the street, is obviously in very poor health. He's out of reach of his family. Like, someone should have been helping him during this time. And he did get, very kind of short-term help if he was in a hospital for a few days or a few weeks, but there are a lot of people, a lot of mentally ill people out there who kind of just get treated like hot potatoes by the system, where, if you're in a shelter, they can't handle you, so they ask to send you to a hospital. The hospitals don't want to keep people anymore, so there's just kind of it's a very uncoordinated system, if you want to even call it a system.
And your article describes Marshall Simon's life as an endless circuit of hospitals and jails, outpatient psychiatric programs, and the streets. And Dr. Carino, I want to bring you in on an aspect of that, because Andy's article says that Simon Marshall's ire was sometimes directed at hospitals that were discharging him before he believed he was well enough to leave on his own. And that's the opposite of what many people might assume is the more typical dynamic, right? Everyone wants to be freed from psychiatric hospitalization, and the system locks them in. So what's the Marshall Simon story in that respect, and what does it exemplify for others?
So I think, Brian, that that aspect of the story, it really has to do with access to psychiatric care and services in the community, and really accessible psychiatric care. So really an approach that we've found to be effective is to get out there with teams into the community and really offer and engage individuals with a trusting relationship, a psychiatrist, talk therapy, and medications, and really sort of couple that with access to housing and benefits. And oftentimes patients will respond to that over time. And when psychiatric care and treatment is accessible and truly accessible, people really respond and the risk lowers.
Andy, you even report that Marshall Simon was released from a hospital in 2017 despite saying he thought it was only a matter of time until he would push a woman onto the subway tracks, according to a source who saw some of his medical records. It was that specific?
It was, yes, it was completely that specific. This advocate for homeless people who I talked to had been contacted by somebody who was looking through Simon's records, and the psychiatrist writes in his discharge summary. This is the psychiatrist who's preparing to discharge him, who presumably is trying to make a record to kind of cover himself. The psychiatrist writes that Marshall Simon told him, it's just a matter of time before I push a woman to the train tracks. And that was in 2017. Of course, it's very easy, you know, hindsight is 2020, and maybe people say things like that all the time, but you would think that if someone has a history of hospitalizations, of severe mental illness, even if they don't have a history of pushing people to the train tracks, you would think that, and maybe Dr. Carino can speak to this, that a psychiatric hospital wouldn't be so quick to discharge them.
Yeah, Dr. Carino, if a patient said that to you, what would you do, or what do you hope you would do as the right thing if you were working in an inpatient facility?
Yeah, so and I can't speak to the specific case and don't really know specifics around the case, but I do think that, you know, in terms of our approach and my approach is that if people express risk and there is significant risk of violence to selves or others, that the plan would be to work towards hospitalization. And in particular, that's swiftly coordinated from the community. With regard to just general risk and risk factors, I do think that a lot of there are interventions that can decrease risk. And the majority of individuals with mental health conditions are not violent and can thrive. And even people with homelessness and mental health conditions can thrive with outpatient community-based care. The challenge is that for some individuals, they do have elevated risk for a period of time, and treatment, and oftentimes involuntary treatment, is indicated at that point. And I think that what we found is that the overall risk can really improve if people have access to things like permanent supportive housing and psychiatric care.
Dr. Carino, as a follow-up, New York State's Kendra's Law makes it possible for involuntary hospitalization for people deemed a danger to themselves or others. Does it not get applied often enough by judges, in your opinion?
Yeah, so it's a good question. Kendra's Law is assisted outpatient treatment. It's an involuntary court-mandated treatment for people in the community. Majority of people do accept and can accept accessible care voluntarily, but
it's in the community. It's not involuntary hospitalization, to correct myself.
Correct. That's correct. And so for certain individuals that are higher risk, there can be an involuntary outpatient order or court mandated order for treatment. And so what we found is for some individuals for a period of time, AOT can assisted outpatient treatment can reduce risk. In particular, you know, there are studies to show that AOT can lead to a 63% reduction in episodes of homelessness, 66% reduction in hospitalizations, and importantly, 73% reduction in incarceration. So assisted outpatient treatment can be helpful. It also should be applied judiciously. One of the things that we've found is that in the last 5 years, AOT orders have decreased in New York City itself. And one of the things that we found is that it's challenging currently for community psychiatrists and therapists to apply for AOT from the community, and that access to AOT, we're told that people can access AOT once they're hospitalized, and we depend on the hospitals to file an AOT order. So it's an important intervention that should be looked at and be something that could be more accessible to as a referral source for people that actually know the patients and are treating the patients in the community, as opposed to having it only go through hospitals who may not know the patient well and may not understand the arc of their treatment and their needs.
This is one of those segments where I haven't even given out the phone number, but this is such a big issue in our area right now, as it is in cities around the country, that the lines have filled up with callers before I even give out the phone number. So let's take a caller right now. Irene on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hello, Irene.
Oh, my goodness. I am so thankful to be have you take my call. So we have a son who has had severe bipolar mania for about 12 years now. This is about the 12th year, started when he was 23. He did move some years ago, about 5 years ago, out to California, and I rush out there anytime there's a problem. He has been able, we have gotten him into an ACT program, which is somewhat lower level AOT program out in California. He has a doctor there he really admires and likes. He has people who come, actually they'll deliver food to him if he needs it. Most of the year he's in good shape and he continues with his meds and he does go see the doctor. But about once a year, he has a manic episode. And almost every year it's a crisis and he has to be, you know, admitted into a hospital. This year, for the very first time, he tried to go to a hospital early on in the onset of the mania, and he could not get in because he was not suicidal. It outrages me that with the doctors, like, you know, cooperation and the patient's desire to, you know, try to halt something that's a crisis, that he cannot get in unless he is suicidal or dangerous or a threat to others.
What's the reason that he was given, as specifically as you know it?
The reason is because he was not suicidal or a danger. He was not a threat to others.
Just as you said. Andy, do you want to take that? I mentioned in the intro, another psychiatrist, not Dr. Carino, but another psychiatrist quoted in your article, says people do not fall through the cracks. As we often use that term, they are pushed through the cracks, out the door, into an abyss. I wonder what Irene's story about her son exemplifies and how it relates to your article, if you think it does.
It relates at least tangentially. And Irene, I'm really sorry to hear that happened to your son. It must be just so completely infuriating and frustrating and terrifying as a parent. The psychologist who I talked to, who said people get pushed through the cracks, his name is Javier Amador, and he said that in his opinion, he's not a psychiatrist, he's a psychologist, but he's been dealing with psychiatrists for a long time, that psychiatrists in this country only sort of look to treat immediate, whatever an immediate problem is, and not try to kind of keep people stable over the long term. As far as why Irene's son wouldn't even be admitted, I mean, I don't know what the laws are and why, you know, if you're involuntarily being hospitalized, that you need to be found a danger. But if you're voluntarily attempting to get yourself hospitalized, I cannot picture why a hospital would turn you away. Maybe Dr. Carino can speak to that.
Yeah, Irene, sorry that you had that experience. And I think it sounds really frustrating and is frustrating and really important that he's gotten some good community-based care. I think if someone is and it's good that he's aware of his illness, of his symptoms, and there's an ACT team or ACT team that's supporting him on it. And I think that the hospitals do have limitations and have not. And I think sort of in New York City, what we've seen is that, you know, the coordination between the hospitals and the community psychiatrists and treatment teams could really and should really improve, where there's clear communication between the hospitals and the community treatment providers.
Let me ask you this, Doctor. 50 years ago, there was a deinstitutionalization movement. There was the book and the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There was the belief that many more mentally ill people than previously acknowledged could live outside of institutions. Was deinstitutionalization romanticized to the point where it went overboard, in your opinion?
Well, I think that what needed to happen is that the care and the supports and resources should have been transitioned. And what happened is that as there was deinstitutionalization, there wasn't a reallocation of resources to the community. And we have a patchwork of support. I do think that there's a lot of community treatment that can be effective, but also there needs to be improvement in the coordination and what inpatient hospitalization, psychiatric hospitalization may look like. For example, there's a long-term psychiatric inpatient unit at Bellevue that works with people experiencing homelessness, and the length of stay there is much longer than the, you know, 4 to 6 day length of stay that many of the psychiatric inpatient hospitalizations have in the city, and that inpatient stay is a higher quality, and oftentimes there's better coordination with outpatient providers and leads to people to access housing and get on better psychiatric medication treatment and addiction treatment. So there needs to be a relook at what inpatient psychiatric care looks like, length of stay, and access to the psychiatric beds. There's also been a significant decrease in the number of psychiatric beds that are accessible with COVID. And we've seen a drop in the numbers and units being reallocated towards COVID patients. And that's left a series of problems in terms of accessing inpatient care for our patients. I recently had a patient who had to go to a hospital 20 miles outside of the city instead of the hospital that was close to his family and him that he preferred. And, you know, our team had to coordinate very closely with that hospital in a way that was challenging if we hadn't been calling multiple times throughout the week and case conferencing frequently. So there needs to be more access to longer term, higher support and actual inpatient services in New York City.
Dr. Anthony Carino from the Center for Urban Community Services and New York Times Poverty and Social Services correspondent Andy Newman. Maybe you read his story called Decades Adrift in a Broken System, Then Charged with a Death on the Tracks. Thank you both so much for an important conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.